Today is Earth Day. Started in 1970 in the United States, Earth Day is now an international event and movement. So I'd like to talk about Earth Day for several reasons. I'm going to talk about it in a way that tries to link it to the talk that I gave last month in exploring the role of spiritual communities in social discourse about things like racism, poverty, homelessness, and environmental destruction. I'm going to let these folks settle in. If you heard that talk, you'll remember that it was motivated by a request to have the Zen Center support an organization to defeat a constitutional amendment that will define marriage as being only between a man and a woman. That request stimulated some thinking on my part. I also reflected in that talk on the work that the Zen Center is currently doing in service, in our relationship, our partnership with Joyce Food Shelf, and in our supporting meditation in jails and in detention centers. And I talked about how the Buddhist tradition, unlike Abrahamic traditions of Christianity, Islam, and Judaism, doesn't seem to emphasize social justice. We emphasize compassion and wisdom, but not so much sitting down at the five and dime store in the South to protest racial discrimination or things like that. Churches and synagogues and other spiritual communities were critical to the civil rights movement in this country, and they are active today in this community in issues around racism, social justice, homelessness, and poverty. Now, there may be many reasons for Buddhism's lack of emphasis on social justice. Our emphasis on harmony and the middle way can make it difficult to take a stand. Karma has been used historically to justify inaction. Poor people are poor because of karma. There's nothing to do about it. And Zen has a long history of being a state religion and supporting subservience to the state in both China and Japan. And finally, the ideal of emptiness has been used historically to justify immoral acts, such as killing. If life and death are both empty, life and death are not different. And in Japan, emptiness has been used to justify death, justify killing. So there are potentially a lot of reasons why our tradition doesn't hold social justice highly. That was the last talk. But today is Earth Day. I received an email from a very, very good friend of mine after my last talk. She listened to it on the web. And she had a very strong reaction to it. That talk was not meant to depress people, nor is this one. But it is Earth Day. The first Earth Day was incredibly important to my formation as an adult. It changed the course of my life. In 1970, I organized the first Earth Day at my high school in Western Massachusetts. I still have a photograph from the Greenfield Gazette and Courier that shows me and my fellow organizers standing around a pile of steel cans. We were at a recycling drive, the first recycling drive Greenfield, Massachusetts had ever seen. And they were steel cans. We didn't have aluminum. I don't know if any of you old enough to remember those heavy steel cans with seams at the top and bottom that were doubly heavy. Plastic bottles had not been invented back then. So we need to imagine a couple of things. First, recycling was a brand new concept that ran counter to the exuberant post-World War II belief in endless growth. I actually took a lot of flack for organizing this recycling campaign. My mother and I went toe-to-toe over it, actually, quite a bit. She thought she had gotten to a point in her life, after a very hard life, where she did not have to concern herself with trash. Just flush it. Just get it out. Though I didn't know it at the time, this was the dawning of the great turning, which I'll talk about more in a moment. As I mentioned also in my last talk, I came to Buddhism out of a deep appreciation, a great appreciation and reverence for nature and the natural world. In some ways, that mystical appreciation for an inconceivably complex coevolution led me from the religion of my youth to Eastern thought. I grew up as a Christian, and specifically an Episcopalian, and that was a rather staid version of Christianity. The deep, deep appreciation for the beauty and complexity of the natural world led me eventually to conservation, which is an old term, environmentalism, deep ecology, and eventually Buddhism. I actually got my undergraduate degree in natural resources. I never practiced, but I got a degree anyway. Now, to that reverence for the natural world has been added a reverence and deep appreciation for the human manifestation and understanding exemplified by Shakyamuni Buddha and his followers through the millennia. So I come to this world of environmentalism and ecology over a period of 20 or 30 years that included activism, and it's included education, and it's included my practice of Buddhism. If you haven't noticed, the world is in crisis. I personally believe the ecological crisis is the fundamentally critical challenge of our day. I also think it has two drivers: population growth and increased consumption, or standards of living. And both of those are rooted in the Four Noble Truths. They're both rooted in the first two of the Four Noble Truths. The first noble truth is suffering exists. The second noble truth is that there is a cause of suffering, and that cause is craving, thirst, or greed. Population growth and consumption on a finite planet are manifestations of the human condition as seen by the Buddha. Acquisitiveness and grasping, be it for progeny or material things, they create suffering. You might say this biological acquisitiveness is our karma, our collective karma, not just individual karma, our shared karma. Of course, karma by its very nature is shared. That's what I would like to talk about this morning. As I was walking over here, I heard ruby-crowned kinglets singing, and I noticed bellworts blossoming for the first time. Ruby-crowned kinglets are these tiny, tiny little mites of birds that dart around in the trees very rapidly. And when they sing, you're just blown away because their voice is so robust. You're expecting a much bigger bird. So anyways, it's a beautiful morning. I'd like to start off with a concept or an idea called the Great Turning, which I mentioned earlier. It's a framework put forward by Joanna Macy. Joanna is a current day writer, teacher, Buddhist practitioner, mystic. And I, though I know Joanna, I haven't seen her for over a decade. I've been told, however, that she's pissed at the complacency of the Buddhist community in the face of our current situation. And Joanna is a matriarch. She is well into her 80s, and she's been active for many, many years. She calls this current time the Great Turning. Now, this has a Buddhist connotation to it. Mahayana Buddhism talks about the three turnings of the Dharma wheel. The first turning was Buddha's talks shortly after his enlightenment at Varanasi. And they were focused on the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. And he gave these talks to the people he had been wandering the countryside with for a decade. The second turning was at a place called Vulture Peak, and it's where he explained the concepts of emptiness and compassion. And the third turning took place over took place all over India. And the third turning was the concept of Buddha nature. Now, I'm not going to go into those teachings, but that's the metaphor that Joanna is using. And there are other the three turnings of the Dharma wheel is used in other ways in Buddhism as well. But she's taken this concept and now applied it to describe the evolution of human consciousness. So, the first turning, or the three turnings, are the agricultural revolution, the industrial revolution, and the current turning, the great turning, the environmental revolution. And we entered each of these revolutions with a certain consciousness and worldview and sense of who we are in the world. And we came out of those revolutions with an entirely different sense of who we were, who we are as human beings. So think about it. Human societies came out of the agricultural revolution with a sense of rootedness that changed our sense of community and our relationship with the world and each other. No longer nomads and hunter-gatherers, we were settled in communities, tending and stewarding plots of land. The world became, using our new lenses, a different being. We created new social and civic institutions to guide our communal life. We valued cooperation and saving harvests and trading with people who used to be our enemies. That revolution took a couple of millennia. In this model, the Industrial Revolution is the second turning. And we as a species came out of that revolution with an entirely different worldview and sense of our place in the cosmos. We moved to large cities with complex built environments and consequently lost many of our daily routines that connected us to the natural world. We learned how to extract resources from the Earth's crust, and with new technologies for transportation, the world became much, much smaller. Our daily rhythms changed, as did our relationships with each other. We were now co-workers and employees rather than independent farmers and peasants, albeit probably tenant farmers and peasants. How we conceived ourselves and our place in the universe was quite different on each side of the Industrial Revolution. That revolution didn't take a couple of millennia. It took a century. And now Macy suggests that this third great turning of the wheel, the environmental revolution, is upon us. We're in the midst of a change that is similar to the previous two revolutions. We're moving towards a new sense of what it means to be human, our place in the world, what it means to be. Our values and institutions have to radically change. Maybe a small environmental footprint will be more important than having a good job or a solid career or a lot of money. Maybe having one kid or no kids will be of more value than procreating. On and on it goes. For billions of people across the globe, the world is changing in unpredictable and inconceivable ways. And Joanna suggests that this revolution doesn't have a couple of millennia. It doesn't have 100 years. It has maybe 20 years. And we're probably three-quarters of the way through it. And she's not convinced that we're going to turn the wheel in time. We've overfished our oceans. The climatological system may have already been sent into a pattern that can't be pulled back. Population growth is critical. When my father was born, there were fewer than 2 billion people on the Earth, and it took tens of thousands of years to get those 2 billion people. When I was born, there were 3 billion, less than 3 billion. Today, there are 7 billion, and in 2050, there will be 9 billion. If I'm lucky enough to live to be 90, and I don't know if that's will be considered lucky, the world population will have tripled in my lifetime. That's a lot of people. All needing food, all needing water, all needing sewers, all needing houses. We may need to be figuring out how to reduce population. And some consider that inconceivable. But it might be essential. Consumption is the other elephant in the room, I think. It may be uncontrollable, especially as we think of parts of the globe today where people don't even have sufficient food or water. But it may be essential that consumption be reduced. So that's Joanna's model of the Great Turning, putting where we are today in perspective. It's a way to conceptualize our challenge. It's not real. It's not any more real than any other concepts. But I find it a useful framework for what we are doing now. Because, as I said in my last talk, if we are here to free all beings, which is the great Buddhist vow, we cannot ignore this. So this framework gives me a sense of my hair being on fire. And as I said, it could be considered our karmic genome. We can't, as individuals or a species, avoid karma. It's impossible. We can, however, change it. That is what our practice of Buddhism is. Period. Bottom line. Joanna goes on to elucidate three dimensions of the Great Turning. So this is another little model, but I find it extremely useful. I think of them as three baskets of activity or action. So as we're moving through the environmental revolution, as we are turning this wheel one more time, there are certain types of activities or baskets of activities that are moving us through. The first basket are actions to slow the damage that is being done to the earth and beings. And these activities include political activities, legislative, legal work required to reduce destruction. It also includes direct action, boycotts, civil disobedience, and other forms of refusal. As some of you know, I've been a lobbyist for environmental organizations. As some of you know, I've been arrested several times for civil disobedience around environmental issues. And their current examples of this are regulatory actions to stop ethanol plants from contaminating water in Minnesota, or current lawsuits that are underway to stop corporations or hold corporations accountable for mitigating any damage they do while mining taconite in northern Minnesota. It includes lobbying and conducting vigils. It also includes studying the damage being done and documenting the ill effects on our earth. The work in this basket basically buys time. It saves some lives, some ecosystems, and cultures. It may save some of the gene pool for the society that's going to come on the other side of the Great Turning. But it's not sufficient. It's essential, but it's not sufficient. And it is very, very hard work. People burn out on this work. I'm no longer an environmental lobbyist. The second basket of activity in this Great Turning is an analysis of the causes and the creation of new alternatives. And this work is important because it helps us look at the tacit agreements we have, the stuff that binds us to this economy that is using the earth as a storehouse and a sewer. And it takes courage and a certain amount of confidence and common sense to look at what's happening. And when we see how the system operates, I think we're less tempted to demonize corporate CEOs and politicians who are as much in bondage to it as we are. But importantly, by doing this, by analyzing the current situation, we're also creating new social structures. In countless localities, like green shoots coming up through rubble, new arrangements are being made. They're sprouting. It's like the old workers of the world slogan. In the midst of we must create the new in the shell of the old. Examples of the kind of work being done in this basket are teach-ins and study groups, reduction on our reliance to fossil fuels and conversion to renewable energy, collaborative living arrangements like co-housing and eco-villages, community gardens, community-supported agriculture, consumer cooperatives, watershed restoration. The work of creating the new is taking place. So stopping the destruction, analyzing what's going on, and creating the new are the first two baskets. The third basket in Joanna's work, and I should say, an example of this are teach-ins and study groups. There is a workshop on Joanna's work, which is being held May 11th and May 12th, called Facing the Mess We're In Without Going Crazy. I'll put this up on the bulletin board if anybody is interested in attending it. But it's put on by Kaya Sveen, I think, and she has studied with Joanna. So the third basket is a shift in consciousness. If we make it through this third turning, we as human beings, as sentient beings, are going to have to see the world in a new way, in an entirely different light. For those structural alternatives to take root and grow is going to require a real profound shift in what we value and how we are in the world. And it's happening now. Through workshops like that. This spiritual shift arises as grief for our world. It arises questioning rugged individualism and our sense of separateness, separate beings. It arises as we're joyful when we see positive changes taking place new discoveries that reduce our ecological footprint. And they also arise in a resurgence of wisdom traditions, ancient wisdom traditions, that remind us that the world is sacred, worthy of adoration and protection. So the realizations that take place in this third basket give us hope and keep us from becoming paralyzed panicked. I hope they help us reduce our tendency to stick our heads in the sand. And I hope they reduce our wanting to find scapegoats on whom to vent our fear and anger. Now, I found Joanna's framework to be very helpful in not succumbing to despair and in seeing my actions as part of a greater whole. But like her, I'm not convinced that we'll make the necessary changes to avoid systemic collapse. However, that said, there are some Zen practices that can be very helpful to us as we engage the world. Last month I spoke of the Zen Peacemaker Order's three tenets of not knowing or penetrating the unknown, bearing witness to joy and suffering, and healing ourselves and others. These three are deeply rooted in our Zen tradition and are very relevant to the work of the Great Turning. Not knowing is our practice of not holding views and being open to whatever arises, just as it is, without overlaying it with our preconceived ideas. Not knowing allows us to respond to what is arising more appropriately, more effectively, more spontaneously. It is where creativity takes root. Bearing witness to suffering and joy is to not turn away from the damage that we are doing to the earth. Not turn away from the joy of the ruby-throated kinglet's voice. A few years ago, we had an environmental class here, and we did a field trip, and I mentioned this before, but the field trip was to go out to the nuclear power station northwest of here. What's that nuclear power station called, Sammy?
Monticello.
So we went out, about, I don't know, maybe eight of us, and found a pasture, basically a field, and got out of our car. It was on a dirt road, and took our cushions out to the field and simply meditated facing the plant. We were bearing witness. Unfortunately, it was shortly after 9-1-1, and everybody was on high alert. So as we were sitting there quietly, we had bells, we could ring our bells. We heard a couple cars driving on the gravel road behind us and stopping. And all of a sudden, we're bearing witness to our own anxiety now. And to the second sitting, we rang the bell again, and we got up, and it was the sheriff's department. And they were respectful enough to not interrupt us, but they also wanted to know who we were and what the hell we were doing there, sitting in the field looking at the nuclear power station. But bearing witness, just taking it in. Alternatively, we thought about just going to the edge of the urban area and sitting and taking in the newest McMansion going up. Just taking it in. and watching it happen and watching our response to it, bearing witness, not getting angry about it, or if getting angry, watching our anger. Bearing witness can be, I think, very, very powerful. And then healing self and others is the third tenet. And it arises naturally from bearing witness. And it is as natural as comforting a crying child. But before we can heal ourselves and others, we have to be present to ourselves and others. So those are the three tenets of the peacemaker order. And I'd like briefly to talk about the first three vows of the order, because they are very relevant to, I think, Earth Day. Those three vows are vowing to be oneness, vowing to be diversity, and vowing to be harmony. So those are the first three vows. I vow to be oneness, I vow to be diversity, I vow to be harmony. There's a classic and primary Zen poem entitled Harmony of Difference and Sameness by Sher Dao, an 8th century grandfather of the Soto Zen tradition. And these vows of the Zen peacemaker order arise directly out of that poem, as well as other literature. They represent the mysterious play of light and darkness, fear and grasping, hope and dread, the universal and the particular. I vow to be oneness. People experience oneness in many different ways. As I said, I experienced it in nature first, and that over a decade or two led me to meditation. Some people experience it first in meditation or in prayer. Some people experience it hearing a Sibelius symphony, or viewing a painting, reading a novel, watching ballet. We don't usually function as if we were one with everything. As I said, we usually act as if we are separate, independent actors. We don't see the big pasture in which we are a blade of grass, or a gopher, or a pile of cow manure. We don't see Indra's net. But even if we don't see it, even if we don't think we are that oneness, we are. It's unavoidable. And of course that relates to Earth Day. It's what Earth Day is about. Earth Day is a clarion call to our unity with all beings. The second vow is, I vow to be diversity. This is the flip side of oneness. Oneness can only manifest, universality can only manifest as a specific moment, a specific happening. You and I are separate beings. Beyond that, you and I are made up of myriad beings. I usually don't think of my hands as being separate from my stomach, or the bugs in my stomach as being separate from the bugs in my nose. In my day-to-day comings and goings, I don't usually give any consideration or thought to the thousands of species of fauna and flora that live on and in my body, and without which I couldn't exist, and without me, they couldn't exist. Some of those bugs have co-evolved with human beings, and they need my stomach as much as my stomach needs them. You and I are inconceivable bundles of diversity within inconceivable bundles of diversity. The third vow is, I vow to be harmony. Sher Dao says, grasping at things is surely delusion. According with sameness is still not enlightenment. Neither oneness or uniqueness captures it. It is both of them, and it is neither of them. Our practice is the realization of both oneness and diversity in this moment. We vow to be harmony amidst the clash of our unique perspective and the perspectives of oneness. Harmony is lightly holding both diversity and oneness, separation and unity, absolute and particular in the same moment. That's our practice as sentient beings on a path. That's our practice as Zen Buddhists. And on Earth Day, let's reflect on our purpose here and now. I believe, as I said, we're at a very critical juncture. I believe our hair is on fire. What do we do? How does our practice as Buddhists inform what we do? Which brings me back to part one of this talk and the questions that generated both Dharma talks. What is the role of spiritual communities in politics and social discourse on public policy, taxes, spending? Should religious communities take stands on issues like racism, poverty, homelessness, environmental destruction, sexism, homophobia? Should they organize to slow the destruction of the earth or create new alternatives? My answer is that our hair is on fire. We have to act. We must act as individuals in our daily lives and as spiritual communities. So here are a few ways, a few things we can do. And again, I don't want to depress people. Sit daily. That's just sit daily. And see what happens. The first thing to do, or the first thing that's happening, is not related to Earth Day, but it is related to the last talk. And there were some conversations after the talk, and I'm the board of the Zen Center is going to consider signing on to the organization that wants to defeat the amendment to define marriages between only a man and a woman. So, talk about that at tea. Second, if you're interested, go to Joanna's Macy's website or the website of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship. Learn more. Don't sit back. Third, there will be a sign-up sheet on the bulletin board, and a group of people will be getting together to talk about issues of social engagement here at the Zen Center. I don't know where that'll go. I don't know if it'll lead to a social justice committee. I don't know if it'll just blossom for a few weeks and then fade away. It doesn't matter. But there will be a group getting together, and there's a sign-up sheet, or there will be a sign-up sheet. Would somebody put these up on the board for me after the talk? So there's a sign-up sheet, and there's also then another thing to do is perhaps attend that workshop on Joanna Macy's work. Don't get overwhelmed. We're all in this together. But don't put your heads in the sand. I guess that's the message that I want to leave you with. Don't put your heads in the sand. Our hair literally is on fire. And consider working with those three tenets and three vows of the peacemaker order. It can be a useful way to focus your practice. And again, those tenets are penetrating the unknown, bearing witness to joy and suffering, and healing ourselves and others. And the three vows are: I vow to be oneness, I vow to be diversity, and I vow to be harmony. So, again, don't despair. Use the day to reflect. Reflect how your practice, your spiritual practice, informs how you live in the world, given the fact that our hair is on fire. With that, I think I'm done. Anybody has... we have time for maybe one or two questions or comments.
I have a question for you. What do you think about groups like Earth First?
You know, I don't know. I guess I need to know a little bit more specifically about about both Earth First and what you might be talking about in terms of Earth First.
There's kind of a radical environmental group.
Yeah.
They do like computation of that logging sites and stuff like that.
And like, are they the group that like puts steel spikes into?
That's one of the things that they do.
Yeah. Well, my guess is it's not black and white, but I would emphasize nonviolence and non-harming in anything we do.
I just want to thank you for your talk today. And I know a lot of us come here to leave feeling good, better than when we arrived. But I just wanted to point out that a good Buddhist teacher's job is to make us feel uncomfortable sometimes, and that motivates us to think deeper and act on those thoughts, and maybe do something better than what we were doing before. So thank you.
You're welcome. Any other? We'll take one more. Yes.
What is your sense? I sense that our air is definitely on fire, but I sense that it'll take generations to come back around because it has to be, in my opinion, the education of young people and getting people to take away from consumerism. I mean, it took generations to get here, right? So how long do you think? I don't know if we can even put a time on this, but if it took generations to get here, it seems to me that it'll take generations to move away from where we are.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that the time on the other turning, you mentioned millennia, 100 years, now we're turning, it's happening quite quickly. Mm-hmm. But what's your sense on how long it takes to come away?
Well,
to be on the other side of the turning?
You know, I am, as I say, I'm not convinced that it's possible. Some of the systems are you know, perhaps beyond pulling back. That said, two things. One is on my emails. I have a little at the kind of the closer on my emails at work is a quote. I don't know where it comes from, but it says. Pessimism is the analysis of the situation. Optimism is an orientation of the spirit. And you've got to do something. And so I can't speculate how long it will take or what will happen. But clearly we don't have generations. I don't think we have generations. I don't think we have millennia. But also, I think things are rapidly changing, and I think when you look at the potential of technology, communication to perhaps help transform or help change the way we think. I mean, there are. I think we have to think inconceivably about this. I mean, I think that's the only way to do it, and I hope that's not magical thinking. Could be though, and keep a sense of humor. Keep a sense of humor. I guess that's the other thing you ought to do. And hope. Hope and humor. And just plow on. All right. You're on. Oh, we got one more in this.
Well, just a comment on the sense, the anxiety sense is that there's never enough time to increase.
Yeah.
You know, which permeates. I don't know if that's post-enlightenment or post-industrial revolution. But that is sort of a sense of quality of human life that there's never enough time to do in this life.
Yeah. Thanks, Phil.